Penguin Random House Audio presents Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. This is the author, Louisa Lim. To all those who really fucking love Hong Kong. I don't think I can get the land back. The King of Kowloon. Your furious characters on the red postbox kindle in us a flame we have always known. King of Kowloon by Jennifer Wong. Author's note. Although I lived in Hong Kong for almost all my childhood and some of my adulthood, I am not a native Hong Konger and I no longer live in the city. My position on the sidelines liberates me to write more openly than others. However, my freedom must not come at the cost of my sources. Nowadays, the act of writing about Hong Kong has become an exercise in subtraction. Though the interviews for this book, unless otherwise stated in the text, were carried out prior to the introduction of the national security legislation in June 2020, the broad and retrospective application of the legislation has compelled me to remove some names and details from the text, nevertheless, to protect those with whom I spoke. This act of stripping away the identities of interviewees is all the more painful because my aim in writing this book was to place Hong Kongers front and centre of their own narrative. Yet, in this national security era, writing about Hong Kong's distinct identity is landmined with risk. Indeed, many of Hong Kong's best writers can no longer find the words or even the platforms to express themselves openly. This book owes its existence to all who spoke to me, both named and unnamed. I hope I'm honouring the truth of their words while being mindful of their safety. Prologue. I was squatting on the roof of a Hong Kong skyscraper, sun blazing on my head, sweat dripping into my eyes, painting expletive-laden Chinese characters onto a protest banner 8 stories high, and wondering if I'd just killed my career in journalism. The air was soupy with heat, and through the haze I could see a satisfying tetriscape of rooftops packed so tight they seemed to interlock. I'd come to the rooftop to interview a secret cooperative of guerrilla sign painters who specialised in producing mammoth pro-democracy banners to be slung from Hong Kong's highest peaks. But as I watched, my fingers itched to grab a paintbrush and join in. It was the autumn of 2019, the day before China's National Day, commemorating the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the People's Republic of China, on October 1, 1949. For months, millions of people had marched through Hong Kong's streets in the biggest and most sustained anti-government protests the territory had ever seen. After 155 years as a British colony, Hong Kong had been returned to China in 1997 in an unprecedented transition of sovereignty. Although Beijing had vowed that Hong Kong could preserve its way of life for 50 years, until 2047, China was now threatening to ram through legislation that would renege on that promise. The secret band of calligraphers had been busy deploying their team of rock climbers to scale Hong Kong's crags in the dead of night, so that people woke up to gigantic signs exhorting them to take to the streets to oppose the evil law. Or fight for Hong Kong. The sheer scope of the banners turned the territory itself into a canvas and reinvigorated the protest movement when morale was ebbing. I'd always been fascinated by the audacity of the sign painters, but I had no idea who they were or how to get in touch with them. That morning, someone who knew of my obsession had contacted me out of the blue to invite me to watch them in action. It was an offer I couldn't refuse. The sun-baked rooftop of this tall building offered both the privacy and the expanse necessary to lay out the huge banners and dry them. There were 7 sign painters. I'd promised not to divulge any details that might expose their identities, but I was surprised that instead of the young athletic radicals of my imagination, they were older men and women whose familiarity with one another was evident in the wordless efficiency of their interactions. Working quickly, they unfolded a gigantic bolt of thick black cotton, then used their feet to stamp the material flat on the roof in a brisk communal dance. They placed rocks along the edges to hold the cloth still. Then, an elderly calligrapher began sketching out the characters in white chalk. Moving with a fluid grace, the writer's entire body mirrored the strokes of a calligraphy brush dancing across the fabric, as the piece of chalk dipped and curved, tracing the outline of 4 enormous Chinese characters. As the final ideogram took shape, the words the calligrapher was so carefully inscribing on the banner were He Koi Lo Mo, a sweary and wholly untranslatable pun in Cantonese, the dominant language spoken in Hong Kong and parts of southern China. A literal translation would be celebrate their mother, but this was actually a pun playing on the most popular Cantonese insult, Diu Lei Lo Mo, or fuck your mother. So the actual meaning of the banner was something along the lines of fuck your motherfucking National Day celebrations. In other words, the slogan was calculated to cause maximum offence by mocking the massive military parade to be held in Beijing and at the same time underscoring that Hong Kongers did not consider themselves part of the People's Republic of China. It was an irreverent slap in the face that was simultaneously laugh-out-loud funny and deadly serious, not least because, if caught, the sign painters could face jail time. I watched as they grabbed their pots of paint and silently squatted beside the banner to begin filling in the characters, struggling with my desires. For months, my dual identities as a Hong Konger and a journalist had been engaged in a silent contest of wills, as I tried to safeguard my professional neutrality. This was becoming ever harder as the familiar world I'd grown up in, with all its predictable certainties, collapsed around me. On the surface, it was still the same city, pulsing with energy from the shoals of people surging through the skyscraper-lined streets, the beeping signals at zebra crossings, the LED signs jostling for airspace, the acrid, dried fish reek of a Chinese medicine shop melding with the rich bark smoke aroma of a stall selling tea-steeped eggs. But the apparatus beneath this sensory cacophony was shifting in ways I could no longer ignore. The police, instead of being guarantors of security, were behaving like violent thugs who beat and arrested children for wearing a particular colour, or for standing in a particular street at a particular time, or for nothing at all. The courts, instead of being neutral arbiters of the law, were handing down political verdicts, disqualifying popularly elected legislators from the legislature, and imprisoning people for peaceful protests. The government officials, instead of enacting and administering policy, had disappeared from view, and were limiting their interactions with the populace to violence meted out by the police on their behalf. Overnight, the world had turned upside down. The known rules of engagement no longer seemed to apply, and this was also true for the practice of journalism. Far from protecting reporters as civilians, the police were singling us out for attack. They pepper sprayed us, tear gassed us, shot burning liquid laced with indelible blue dye from water cannons directly at us, pulled guns on us, beat us, arrested us. We'd begun by wearing fluorescent vests and helmets marked press and gate air, but it soon became horribly obvious that we were effectively putting targets on our heads and torsos. The sheer density of Hong Kong's maze of apartment blocks, alleyways and markets meant that few residents were untouched by the government's forceful suppression of the protests. Almost 90% of the population had been tear-gassed. It could happen while you waited for a late night.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?